Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I think about, like, I don't want to bring up 9/11.
Hello and welcome to Pocket Buds, a back pocket podcast where I talk to my best buds about video games and stuff. This week, we're talking about licensed games. The art of the licensed game is one that has presented itself in many different forms. There have been video games based on films and TV shows, video games directly tied into the release of a film or TV show, and even video games that are an interactive play-by-play of the film or TV show they're based on. The early history of the licensed game is a fairly foggy one. When it comes to the first licensed game to ever be released, you could say it was Atari's Shark Jaws, which was released in 1975 and was based on Jaws. The only problem is that Shark Jaws was actually an unlicensed tie-in to the film, because when Atari came to Universal asking for a license, Universal said no. So really, the first actual licensed game was Fonz, released by Sega in 1976 and based on the cool guy from Happy Days, A. However, this game wasn't even originally Fonz. It was released earlier in the year as Road Race. It's got nothing to do with Happy Days. It's a lie. So actually, the first proper licensed video game was Superman for the Atari 2600, which was released in late 1979 after the financial success of the 1978 film. And this was legit too, because Atari was owned by Warner Communications at the time, who also owned DC Comics, so they were basically like siblings. And the Superman game is, their baby? Or something? Don't worry about it. The critical and financial success of Superman for the Atari 2600 could be viewed as the springboard for what would become the wacky world of licensed games. Since then, there have been an unlistable amount of games released based on licensed properties. Some are considered classics like GoldenEye 007, and others were so bad that they were doomed to landfill, like the E.T. game. For a good while, licensed games seemed to exist as ways for production companies to make a little more cheese from the properties they owned. I mean, was anybody really asking for a Fight Club game? If you saw Fight Club and thought, "I sure wish I could play this," I think you might have missed the point on that one. Sorry! Today, we're not seeing as many licensed tie-in titles upon the release of films or movies. Instead, there are a whole lot more coming out set in the worlds of licenses, like Telltale's The Walking Dead and PlayStation's Spider-Man series. And Gollum, that one too. Personally, I grew up in a time where most movies and TV shows had their own video games. My time with the PlayStation 1 consisted of every tie-in game for the many, many Mary-Kate and Ashley movies, and the very first game I played on the Xbox 360 was a double pack of Kung Fu Panda the video game and Lego Indiana Jones. They all thoroughly rocked my world. But I'd be lying if I didn't admit that my experience with these sorts of games is ultimately quite limited post-childhood. The world of licensed games is one that has confounded and amazed me in the sheer volume of titles that exist within it. But I figured I'd probably be better off spending my hard-earned money on quote-unquote real video games. So in order to expand my horizons and open my eyes to the likes of games such as Pixar's Cars and Scarface, I'm joined by YouTube reviewer, licensed game appreciator, and my friend, Peter, also known as Mini-Me.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
Happy to have you here. Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah,
was
absolutely.
Was it a forgiving journey to get here?
Yeah. It was peaceful.
Oh,
I was feeling good.
You love to hear it.
Yeah.
So what is it about licensed games and obscure games, forgotten games that draws you in that you love so much?
I think I really enjoy seeing like adaptations of things in any form, whether it's like a video game adapting a sport or like a video game adapting a James Bond film. I think there's something like fascinating about that. Like I'm a strange person who... I to get to sleep at night, I design video games in my head.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's you should try it. It works really well.
That does sound good. I mean, usually, what do I put a video on. I'll be
listen,
honest.
Listen
I put
to like a Mini-Me video.
Yeah, I put on my favorite Mini-Me video yeah, right. And I go to sleep like a baby. But I usually put a video on, and then if that doesn't work, I track my day backwards.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I should try that too.
I'm trying to remember who told me like to do that, but they were like, just go over your day in like excruciating detail backwards in your head. And I'm like, okay. And I get so bored with it that yeah. I fall asleep. I'm like, wow, what a shitty day. Good night. And what was the first licensed game that you played?
I think like the first game I ever played was GoldenEye, which is funny because I was like 4 and there's like blood dripping down the screen and shooting each other and gunshots. And yeah, kid me was blown away. Being a younger sibling, the youngest sibling in the 90s or early 2000s as well, was sort of like every culture was really edgy at the time. And me being a kid wanting to be like my oldest siblings was like, I'm playing an adult game.
Yeah.
This is an edgy sort of, and it was also GoldenEye, which is like, you know, an all-time classic game. And we played multiplayer a ton, and the theme tune was lodged into my brain. And I liked James Bond so much, my grandma took me to see Die Another Day when I was 6. Which I'm starting to think that my upbringing was a little weird.
I think that was the first James Bond movie that I saw as well. And I didn't know that there were James Bonds before Pierce Brosnan.
Right. Yeah,
I thought
neither.
He just started that whole thing. And I'm like, good on you, Pierce.
Yeah, look at him.
He did the thing. That's
really
great.
Made this character.
Yeah.
Yeah. And since then, like, I seeked out more and more Bond games, and then, you know, I would absorb Disney movies and Star Wars films and Lord of the Rings films. And through the 2000s, almost because of GoldenEye, there was like a boom in licensed games.
Totally.
That was like an arms race almost. It's like EA kind of, they got Bonds, they got Harry Potter, they got Lord of the Rings. And then LucasArts started drumming up with their Star Wars games. And Activision got like Shrek.
Yeah. Acclaim Entertainment got the crumbs.
Yeah, yeah.
Of anything that was left.
THQ got SpongeBob and people like those games a lot.
THQ is such an interesting one. I feel like they released so many licensed games.
Yeah. It stands for Toy Headquarters.
No way.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Huh. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Games are like toys.
Something you never think about.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
THQ. Yeah, I think they went away for a bit because they fell
died.
Apart. They died. But then came back as THQ Nordic. I think they're back in the licensed game.
I think so a little
zone.
Bit. I can't think of an example.
Yeah. Immediately I'm like, yeah, just like, oh, that one. Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like GoldenEye was not entirely peak, but it definitely, like Superman, you could say started the trend, but GoldenEye started the trend of it happening way more often.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they were like, through the 80s, like Disney were really good at games through the 80s and 90s, like the Aladdin game and the Lion King game and DuckTales and all that.
Yeah.
But that's before my time. I was impressionable when the sort of EA era of licensed games blew up. And so
Have you tried playing Lion King and Aladdin?
Not since I was like really young. Dude. So isn't it really hard?
They did a re-release on Switch of those two. It was like a double pack. And I was I got a copy of it through work. I don't think I've ever been so angry at a game in my life. Because like Aladdin was fine. Aladdin was a pretty standard platformer, but Lion King was ruthless. Like I don't know if I ever figured out how to attack. Because you're just like the baby lion. You're just Simba,
right?
Running
just
around,
getting your ass kicked.
Getting your absolute shit rocked. And it's like, what am I supposed to do? I was jumping around trying to like jump on the hyena, but every time I touched the hyena, it would hurt. And I'm like, what's happening right now? And instead of like taking a breath in and learning it, I was like, fuck it, I give up. That's not right.
I know the feeling.
This game was not made with me in mind.
Yeah.
So what were some of the Disney games that hooked you in?
I really liked DuckTales, but they weren't games I played a lot growing up. It's just like I wrote a piece for Lost in Cult recently, about sort of the history of licensed games through the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And it really struck me how like Disney were almost the only good ones through that period. Yeah. Like then you had like Top Gun and E.T., E.T. and like just... shit. I don't know. There's no way to describe it. Games that were made in like a month or 2 weeks and just pushed out the door. And
because they had a release date to
movie. And that's I guess if we're talking about like why licensed games fascinate me so much, it's like if you think of like video games as an art form and like the creative
that was the last episode.
Yeah, look, nice little tie-in. They're sort of a big collaborative creative process and they're really hard to make, like especially with big teams. And to add in another element of like a license holder that's upset and a movie studio that's upset and they're just pushing constraints onto you, and it's really fascinating to me to see developers navigate not only the perils of developing a video game but also adhering to these studios that want the tight release date, or they want, you know, you can't do anything experimental with this IP. Or sometimes you can, and that's also fascinating too. Like sometimes it'll be a meeting of these like auteur types. Like you'll have like Peter Jackson and Michel Ancel from Ubisoft, who's been sort of cancelled recently. But they're both like these big thinking, ambitious minds. And so they both went in on Peter Jackson's King Kong, the official game of the movie.
My God.
Which is a long name.
Yeah.
And so that game ended up being incredibly ambitious and boundary pushing and sort of finding those stories is really fascinating. And then comparing them against the disaster stories like E.T. is something that my mind just likes to think about, I suppose.
I think the really interesting thing with the ones like E.T. and I think one of the first ones that comes to mind that was originally in the script for the intro, but then I was like, no, I'm cutting it out, was Star Trek Phaser Strike, which was for the Multivision.
Oh, yeah, Multivision.
Milton Bradley.
Yeah, that's it.
He made his own console, Mr. Milton Bradley, and he had Star Trek Phaser Strike because he made a deal with – who owned Star Trek? Was it Paramount?
I don't know.
The production company that owned Star Trek – made a deal with Milton Bradley to release Star Trek Phaser Strike on the Multivision. But the Multivision was a very simple console, incredibly simple console. And therefore, that Star Trek game, in the actual game itself, no connection to Star Trek because it was blocks. It was the most simple pixels you could see on a screen. So simple that when that deal ended with the production company that owns Star Trek, they were able to re-release it as just Phaser Strike, take out all mention of Star Trek, not mention it at all on the box or anything like that, and if you had never seen Star Trek Phaser Strike before, you would be none the wiser.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like there's that sort of licensed game, which, I mean, it became unlicensed, but that sort of licensed game which had pretty much no connection and Fonz as well, which was just Road Race, those games that kind of just had it slapped on the box, versus a game like King Kong, which was so ambitious and had such a large amount of input put in by the production companies, What do you think made that change? Made production companies and studios decide to take more initiative when it came to video game tie-ins? Do you think it was E.T.?
I think E.T. scared them away from it. A lot circles back to GoldenEye, honestly. See, the thing, if you look through the top sellers of, and I know I'm talking about like a specific window of games in like the mid-2000s a lot, but that's when a lot of the games I cover came out, and that's also when a lot of the games that were like this came out.
Yeah.
If you look at the top sellers on the PS2, Xbox, and GameCube from around 2001 through 2005, top 20 always had like a whole bunch of Bond games and a whole bunch of Harry Potter games and a whole bunch of Lord of the Rings games. Mm. And the early ones were kind of like quick rush jobs like licensed games always have been. And then we hit the mid-2000s, 2005 exactly is when Peter Jackson's King Kong came out.
It's so important.
Yeah. And studios, like game studios, were looking at the success of these, and movie studios were looking at the success of these, and were like, we can push this a little bit further. And so we ended up with some really fascinating games out of that, like Peter Jackson, not who's James Cameron.
James Cameron.
Another big, you know, famous white guy director.
I get those two fellas mixed up all the time.
Yeah, so James Cameron's Avatar 2009 is like one of the most, is probably the most visually or technically impressive game of 2009.
Time. Yeah.
And that was because like Cameron Studio was sharing all their assets and they enlisted Ubisoft to make it. Mm. Who were sort of, they also made Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Yeah. Did they also make the newest Avatar game?
They did.
They did.
And that's a good example too.
Yeah, we'll get to that one.
We'll get
though.
There. We'll get there. Yeah. The game isn't amazing, but you know, it's kind of like any games. Like sometimes they come out and they're great, and sometimes they come out and they're not. And sometimes that has nothing to do with whether they're licensed or not. Don't know what happened during the development of this, but by all reports, it was a massively collaborative game. Mm-hmm. And then, like, it came out, no one cared, still no one cares, but it looked absolutely gorgeous. And I think there's an element in what I do covering these games where I'm like, this game actually did something really great for the time, and no one cares. And I want to talk about that because it's interesting.
Totally. I feel like Peter Jackson was with that King Kong game in my eyes. I definitely feel like he was one of the early movie men who saw games as like a viable and tangible way to tell a story. Like I feel like a lot of people in the film industry still kind of just saw it as like
kiddie thing.
Exactly.
It's always for kids.
A product and not a good way to tell a story. Peter Jackson, I feel like, was a really good example of taking it a bit more seriously. And then James Cameron was the next person to kind of take it more seriously. And I feel like you see that in Avatar Frontiers of Pandora, because that game's supposed to be a part of the universe. It's supposed to be a part of like the ongoing story of Avatar.
Yeah.
And like that's so cool.
Yeah, you know? I think so. And there's interesting, like if we're talking about big Hollywood people who are into video games enough to care about these, another tentpole figure, weirdly enough, is Vin Diesel, which you wouldn't expect.
I wouldn't. I feel like I don't think of Vin Diesel as often as I maybe should.
I think about him too much.
we're balancing out here.
That's right. He started a studio called Tygon Studios in the early 2000s to make a Riddick, I could be wrong on this, but I think it was to make a Riddick MMO.
Holy.
And I think it's never been cancelled. And I think like every 5 years or so, they're like, hey, you still making that? And he's like, yeah, it's coming.
I am.
Or he's in Vin Diesel, he's like, yeah. Anyway, he released the Chronicles of Riddick, or him, he collaborated his studio with a studio called Starbreeze.
Right.
Who were very famous. They made The Darkness and Syndicate 2012, which are like, in terms of like cult favorites on the internet, those are like through the roof.
People
but
love
in real
the
life,
darkness.
No one cares.
That's got a really like cult following.
Yeah, absolutely. So before The Darkness, they made The Chronicles of Riddick: Escape from Butcher Bay with Vin Diesel's help, and it was an incredibly high production game. Exhibit is in it, which is fascinating.
If I'm not mistaken, apparently, like, From what I've read, because I know about this game. From what I've read, like it's considered to be better than the film.
Oh, it is. It's 100%. It's fantastic. Like,
it's just so rare.
I think there's kind of a duo of like, this is such like terminally online.
But
there's like a duo of games from 2004 that are FPS games that everyone talks about as like the top shelf. And it's Doom 3 and Half-Life 2.
Yeah.
And I think Riddick's right there as well.
Like, and I think we got to put Riddick right there.
We're
going
to put
right
a third in one in. Like, it is fantastic. Like, if you ask me eventually what my favorite licensed, or what I think is the best movie game, it's probably The Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah. All right, let me just like cross
let's just
that
backspace.
One off.
Yeah.
Shit.
Like, just completely frazzled when you're reading
well,
it.
Well, okay, I got no more questions.
What do I do now?
Show over. No, I mean, like, yeah, it's so rare for a licensed game to be better than the licensed.
Yeah, 100%. And it adds so much to that universe. And
and it's a whole other level because it's interactive as well.
Yeah.
And I feel like it can sometimes be hard to toe the line of a video game based on a movie or based on a movie property, because you want to give people the air of interactivity, but you also want to tell a very specific story.
That's right.
And so you don't want them to stray too far. Like, oh, that's something that the character wouldn't do.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to be like, get back in line.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Know? And like with Riddick, the world... The world that Vin Diesel's trying to... No one cares about Riddick more than Vin Diesel. Like,
I think that's beautiful.
It's kind of wonderful. Right? Like, apparently he's a big D&D guy, which I like.
Yes, sick.
But Riddick is like a very high concept sci-fi fantasy world.
Yeah.
And that's easier to world build in like a 10-hour game than it is in like a 1.5-hour movie, if you know what I mean. Like, you have more time to flesh out this world. And it kind of like... The universe that he's created and put all this thought into, he could never quite bring it to life on screen in probably the way he wanted to.
Yeah.
I'm talking like he made the game. It was like he was sitting on the computer in his basement.
One man show, baby.
But when you bring all of that world building that he did and couldn't cram into his films and put it in a game, it's like the game serviced this license better than the films ever did. And that's kind of a beautiful and wonderful thing. And again, something I like to highlight because, you know, it's a weird thing. Like, there are more worthy causes to represent, I think, than sort of like raising my fist for licensed games.
Licensed games are just such a fascinating thing because I feel like it spans a lot of different, like you've got TV show games, you've got movie games, but then you've also got games based on toys and games based on fast food chains, but like obviously we're more in line when we're talking about the movies and TV show games, but like it's huge. It's so much bigger than you think. But recently, and I might be wrong on this, maybe I just haven't kept my eyes peeled, you know. I think I've surprisingly enough probably played a fair few more licensed games in recent years than the years before, purely because I kind of want that thrill. I played Bratz: Flaunt Your Fashion.
Yeah, my partner played that too.
That shit rocks.
She loved it. it's a throwback to Rock Angels.
Oh, yeah.
What's the other one? The yellow one.
Yeah. I know the one you're talking
Diamonds,
about.
Diamonds.
Diamond.
Those games are cool, man.
They rock. Yeah. Like, I feel like they were quote-unquote girl games, but they put effort into them.
Yeah.
You know, they actually kind of gave a shit about giving girls like a cool experience in video games. And I loved those Bratz games and I love Flaunt Your Fashion. I definitely had to bring myself down to its level and remind myself that I was a mid-20s woman playing these games. I can't exactly expect them to be high art, but I really enjoyed myself, you know?
Yeah.
But other than that, and like, you know, maybe there are just some kind of quieter titles coming out, I feel like there have been less licensed games being made nowadays, or at least like not as many movie, like direct tie-in games being made.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think video games are like extremely volatile to develop at the moment.
Yeah.
As we say, as there's probably like another new news article of 1,000 people being laid off.
yeah, let me check my phone real quick.
Yeah, honestly. It's pretty tragic, but like, yeah, games get perpetually delayed, and if they are bad, like Gollum or that King Kong game recently, like they're not going to make any money. It's not like it was 20, 30 years ago where like being on a video game shelf was enough exposure to sell a bunch of copies.
Yeah.
But licensed games do still come out, and I think they're ramping up slightly at the moment again, like with Avatar and with Spider-Man. And then on a smaller level, you have games like like Gollum. I think Gollum was like a $20 million production, which is kind of sad.
Yeah. I mean, I that's so much money.
Yeah, but, I know.
I think I have a really soft spot for Gollum. Like the
have
Gollum
you played
game?
It? I haven't no. played it. Yeah, I do too, but I haven't played it yet.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. I really want to play it, and I've got a soft spot for it because, I mean, I don't know, even games that are floptacular, it kind of feels like people still worked on it and people still put
and love and care went into it.
Exactly. And I feel like with Gollum in particular, from what I've seen, the story itself was really interesting. And what they were trying to go for in a narrative sense.
Pretty compelling idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredibly compelling. It was just the gameplay and the UI, and maybe it was a little buggy that kind of made people turn up their noses at it, which, like, fair enough. But also, I don't know. It seems like a game that with a little more polish, a little more time put into it, maybe a little more money, who knows, it could have been a lot better than it was.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think it's cool that it exists. Mm. I think it's cool that it was greenlit.
Yeah.
Because it's been a long time since that sort of mid-budget licensed game. Oh, and it's coming back. Like there was a Tintin game a couple of months ago that looks really polished. I don't think it is, but like the screenshots look polished.
Yeah.
And there's RoboCop and there's Gollum. And there is kind of emerging this middle market for licensed games again. And Lord of the Rings kind of stuck around with the Shadow of Mordor.
Yeah, Shadow of Mordor.
Didn't really like those games, but they did stick around.
Yeah. And then there's another Lord of the Rings game coming out from Weta Workshop in New Zealand, which is cool. Really cool.
Yeah.
And like Rugrats Adventures in Gameland is a DuckTales-like game I had a go of.
That's
and
fun.
That game's really fun.
Yeah.
It's very cute.
Cool.
Yeah. And like
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles just came out a year ago. Which is cool.
But it feels like, and they're still coming out and doing their thing, but I feel like it's not on the same level as like...
It's not like it used to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like you usually had games coming out at the same time, if not a little bit earlier, than a movie coming out, for example, or like while a TV show was airing. And I feel like that just doesn't happen as much anymore.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. I think deadlines kind of screw up games.
Yeah.
And I think that must be a big part of it. And as there was a time in like 2007, 8, 6-ish where we sort of entered the HD era and production costs skyrocketed and now we're here and everything's terrible. but
yeah. Yeah.
At that time, the big publishers kept announcing their departure from licensed games and they kept breaking agreements and being like, we don't want anything to do with this anymore. It's way too expensive to make games and we can't afford to give half our profits or however much of our profits to, you know, MGM or Universal or Paramount or whatever it is. So that kind of like nosedived the licensed game for the last 15 years.
Totally. I also feel like the death of in-house game studios within production companies was a huge thing as well. Like once Disney Interactive was gone, it was over for them.
It was done. And LucasArts as well,
my
they
God,
died.
Yeah. And Vivendi Universal.
Yeah, that was a big one.
Oy, oy, oy.
Oh, sad.
There were so many.
The tear to the eye.
They went away. And they brought with them so many MMOs as well.
Yeah.
Like Disney Interactive on its own, I think, had like four or five running at once.
Yeah, it's you forget because all of the games are like literally dead and impossible to play now, but like there was the Lord of the Rings MMO, there was the Matrix Online.
Pirates of the Caribbean
Online.
Yeah,
Pirates of the Caribbean. That's
Toontown.
Crazy.
I did an episode of this with one of the big boys over at Elder Scrolls Online.
I saw him at PAX.
Yeah. He's a very nice man. And he we had a chat about MMOs, obviously, and talking about just how many have existed and how many have died. And it's so fascinating just how many of them are based on like pre-existing licensed properties.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. When I first like really started getting serious about YouTube, one of my like little ideas in my head was like I'm going to try and discover the stories of all these dead MMOs and the people trying to revive them but it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I think licensed games kind of went away because games got too expensive and publishers didn't want to share their profits. I think now it's a little different. Like, I think now Unity and Unreal has, like, given rise to the mid-budget game in a really accessible way for smaller studios, for one thing, which is propelled licensed games back into reality a bit. But I think the main thing is it's really hard to stand out at the moment if you're releasing a game. Like, you hear stories of indie devs who release their game on Steam and it just vanishes. And you're like, damn, that must be heartbreaking.
No, it sucks. Or, or like they have like a disagreement with a publisher.
Oh, yeah, which and then, it just all falls apart.
Like, I think it was a really great game. I think it's back up now, but Roots of Parcha had some kind of disagreement with their publisher, the developer did, and it came and it left. And then it came back again. But then there was another one, I think The Outbound Ghost. I know so many different games where just like they got taken off of storefronts because they had a disagreement with the publisher. And it's so weird how that can just happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just vanishes.
It's just gone.
And like, if it's a small enough indie game, like no one's backed it up on Pirate Bay, you know, it's just gone. And that's really sad.
I mean, what was it? I think 80% of retro US games are unplayable.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is tragic.
That's so many.
I know.
That's so many games.
Yeah.
Oh my God. If you try and download them off some website, you just get malware.
Yeah, I know. The websites are so scary and you have to know the good ones.
Websites are terrible. Can I say something? Can I say something controversial? Websites are so fucking scary.
I know.
I want to do is I want to play Barbie as Rapunzel.
I know. The Barbie games were so good.
Barbie games, I feel, are on a whole nother level.
I think so too. I think Secret Agent Barbie is like an iconic moment in stealth game history.
Oh my God. Genuinely, they put so much work and effort into the Barbie games.
Yeah, yeah, they're really good.
Like, we're talking Bratz games and we're like, oh, Bratz games are amazing. The Barbie games,
yeah.
Not only were there so many of them, but each one felt different.
Yeah, they did a really good job. Barbie fashion designer.
Yes.
Which was like the big one.
Yeah.
Apparently that sold like... That's like one of the most selling games of the 90s, like of any game. And no one talks about it.
Oh my God.
Licensed games just get faded into obscurity until some strange Australian YouTuber starts talking about them on their YouTube channel.
That boy's name is Mini-Me.
That's right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Video games as a platform aren't taken super seriously by the average
schmo. No.
But then licensed video games aren't taken seriously by the average video game schmo.
Yeah, they're on a whole lower level to the video game discourse.
Which is it's sad because I feel like I don't think people consider games like GoldenEye to be like what they think of as a licensed game. I think people just see that as a video game.
Yeah, because it transcended it, you know?
Yeah.
It's and there's so many, like something I do occasionally is try and get in touch with the people who made the games.
Mm.
And so there's some really fascinating stories that come out of licensed games that probably like wouldn't otherwise get told. Like if we're on Bonds, the Quantum of Solace game, 2008, EA ditched the license in that period because they just wanted to get out of licensed games. So Activision were like, we'll give this a crack. And then they gave Treyarch's B team 6 months to make it.
Oh.
And this was during the writer's strike in 2008 and the GFC.
Oh my God.
And the script for Quantum of Solace was being written on set by the director and Daniel Craig. Like they were co-writing it too. And Craig was like, he always talks about it. He's like, I don't fucking know what I was doing, man. Like,
I don't write. Shit.
Yeah. So I was talking to one of the lead producers on Quantum of Solace, the game by Treyarch. And he is so proud of how they managed to get that game out the door.
6 months with nothing.
With nothing. So they took Call of Duty and they basically just plugged Bond assets into it.
Well, if it works.
Yeah. And because Quantum of Solace was such a mess, 20 minutes into the game, you're playing 20 minutes of Quantum of Solace, the game, and it is an adaptation of the film Quantum of Solace.
Yeah.
And then Bond has a flashback to the previous Bond film and the remainder of the game is Casino Royale because they didn't have a script for Quantum of Solace.
Oh my God.
So they adapted the previous game in the game called Quantum of Solace. And it was just a big 6 month crunch for this team who were like just really trying to like keep their head above water the whole time. And these are the stories that I find so like amazing and fascinating and don't often get told because, you know, licensed games are on that tier below where no one cares. Where like, you know, you hear the big stories about Cyberpunk or Anthem or anything Jason Schreier does a write-up about. And
anything mentioned in Blood, Sweat, and Pixels.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what you hear about.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. But there's a lot of amazing, fascinating stories to be told in the world of licensed games. Though.
Absolutely, because they have this whole other
dynamic to work with,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. It's crazy. And yeah. I mean, like, they are such beautiful things, but I mean that there are honestly there are some stinkers.
And
we can say
so many.
We can say it.
the majority.
Yeah, right. Have you ever played a game based on a film or TV show? And I'm sure you've played quite a few, but were there any that really stuck out where you were like, I don't think this needed to exist?
It's hard because you can always see how they were greenlit. So if you're looking at it from like a business perspective, you're like, I see why this exists. But yeah, there's some terrible games. The Fast and Furious franchise has had the worst run of video games. And it's almost bizarre that it has because like Need for Speed is kind of just the Fast and the Furious. Yeah, it's kind of, and they never quite made a game like that. But I reviewed a game last year called The Fast and Furious Showdown, which came out when Activision were getting out of licensed games themselves. Yeah. So they just shit it out the door. That's a funny phrase. That's an interesting
mental
image.
They shit it out the door. They shit it on the track.
Yeah, that's right. They shit it wherever they wanted to. And it's bad. It's like, so like the development team clearly didn't have enough time to put this together.
Yeah.
And Activision wanted it on home consoles and the 3DS. So they developed it for the 3DS and then ported it to the home consoles and sold it as a full price release.
Oh my
God. So it's just like a retexture of like a 3DS, like remodel the cars are different of a 3DS game. And it's shocking. And really bad. Like it's a driving game. Like the 3DS couldn't handle like advanced physics.
Yeah.
In any sort of real way. So when you're throwing in cars which are just momentum based objects,
oh my God,
like it just didn't work.
Yeah. You can play Mario Kart 7.
Yeah.
Anything else with that kind of movement?
Yeah, don't even try. But so there's a ton of games, not a lot come to mind because I kind of just delete them out of my head, but there's a ton of games that I'll like try and it'll just suck and I'll be like, they're like, people were asking me to cover the, well, not asking me, they'll be like, this is a game Mini Me would cover, for that King Kong game last year.
Yeah.
And like, I don't want to cover that. Like, I don't have anything to say. Like, it's clearly just a sad situation where like a publisher wanted to shit it out the door.
Yeah.
And like, there's no value in making fun of it. You know, like real people probably put a lot of hard hours into this. Like, I don't know.
I think Kong is right. Skull Rise of Kong. Kong Rise of Skull.
Skull. Rise of Kong, Skull Island.
Is it Rise of...
We should Google this.
Shit. Rise of... I always forget what it is. Rise... Skull... I think it's Kong Rise of Skull Island. And I might be wrong. Or that one of them... There's one word at the start. I know that for sure. And I'm pretty sure it's...
Skull Island Rise of Kong.
Okay. Skull Island... I was close.
Maybe the name was a problem as well.
Yeah, that was not, that was a poor name choice. Skull Island, Rise of Kong. I feel like if they did Rise of Kong, Skull Island, that might have been
better.
Fine.
That's a bit better.
And all you need to do was, you know, swap out where what words were you know, on the other side of the colon.
Yeah.
But like that game, I mean, I think it's very funny to just like chuck a PNG into it, into like the middle of like a 3D game. Yeah. I think it rocks. I think it's funny as hell. I think it was also a game that was probably made, as has been said in articles, to very strict constraints and a very short deadline.
Yeah. Like it's a hilarious game.
Funny as hell.
Yeah, like that's not what I'm saying. I don't want to like do a write up on it, you know? Like I just want to be like, yeah, look at that thing.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Womp womp. Yeah, a bit of that. Yeah, exactly. But I think mentioning the 3DS game, there was a very interesting time in licensed games where you'd get games for home consoles and then you get games for handheld consoles that were, and they'd both be the same movie. A shot in the dark. I'm not sure if this is a fine example, but let's say like a Toy Story movie was released and you had a game on Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 and maybe Wii, and they were the same game.
Yeah.
But then you had a game of the same name also released on handhelds, and they were completely different games.
Yeah.
I think that was one of my favorite moments of licensed games. And they were usually made by different studios as well.
Yeah.
Why do you think they decided to just go for completely different games on handheld consoles?
Often they, during that time, the console ones were trying to be like cutting edge and keep up with the big boys because production costs weren't super high.
Mm.
So they couldn't really port those down to something like the 3DS or the DS or the GBA, which I guess just result. It's always funny. Like I've spoken to people who've made those games, and that's really fun because they're on a whole other level of obscurity and detachment from what they're making.
Yeah,
but yeah, I really love it when that happens. Like Quantum of Solace has a normal game and then a different Wii game and then a different again PS2 game, which is a third person shooter, and then a different again 3DS game. So they made four of those.
Oh my God.
And I talked to the developer who made the PS2 game and they were like, yeah, the script was fucked. And we didn't even, like, we weren't even anywhere near that. Yeah. We were just getting tips from Treyarch who themselves were freaking out.
They're like, okay, so his name is James Bond. Yeah.
We'll start there. So they were like all the way down the bottom of the food chain of this movie that was a disaster of a filming. And it's really funny talking to them because they're like, yeah, we didn't know what we were doing, you know? Like,
God. It's basically the same as making a game from scratch.
Yeah, yeah, at that
with
point.
A few pluses.
Like a one-page PDF or something.
Yeah, we got a guy called James Bond.
Do your best. Good luck.
He shouldn't have gone.
Yeah, he's a bit toxic and manly.
Figure it out.
That's right.
He has a martini.
Yeah.
Fit that in.
Yeah. But yeah, I loved that. I always loved... That was actually how my channel kind of took off. I was covering like handheld games.
Yeah.
And a lot of those were just like versions of console games. And getting into why those were so fascinating and had their own little, you know, story to tell, I suppose. Like I did the handheld game. I did a video on Driver 3 GBA. And it's a fully 3D open world game on the GBA.
On like GBA,
like behind the character, and you walk around stealing cars. And,
whoa!
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And so, the developers that made that are named Velez and Dubail, and they're French. So it's a
I don't think I've ever heard of that studio before.
Yeah, no, there's only two of that. Like, it was literally the two guys, like Velez and Dubail.
Literally. Oh my God.
It was a duo, and they were like programming wizards. They like did the most incredible work on the Game Boy and the Game Boy Advance, and. And this was kind of like the ultimate product for them to make.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like to them it was like a licensed game, even though it wasn't. Because like they're just like sort of working under Atari, like distantly being like, can you make a game about this IP that we're making the real game for? You know? So I find that really fascinating too. But, you know, not actually a licensed game. So.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of your channel. You know, you've been doing the dang thing for a bit now.
Mm.
What was the first video of yours that kind of took off and why do you think it did?
People love clicking on list videos.
Oh, yeah.
They love them.
Oh, yeah. Watch Mojo.
That's
hook
it.
That oh, into my oh. veins. That's like crack to me.
That's right. Don't care if it sounds like it's written by ChatGPT.
Yeah, it's the most interesting. Oh, the top 10 people who in movie who shouldn't have done that. It's like, oh, shit. All right.
So I made a video called in 2016. Well, like I started doing this in like 2012.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
12 years ago.
Yeah, I was in high school and I had really bad public speaking skills. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to practice these.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah,
yeah. I think so. Do you think you've gotten better?
Hope so.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. I haven't like actually done a big speech in front of a crowd since a while, maybe. Anyway. So yeah, I just like reviewed games that I thought, and they were pretty similar games to what I review now. Like I reviewed like Kane and Lynch and Homefront.
Yeah.
And like, I have weird, like, I'm really into like ultra masculine manly games.
They're so fascinating.
Yeah. Like it's funny. So they were kind of like naturally they were bad, but like 16-year-old making it, you know.
Everybody's got to have their start of making.
That's
some,
right.
Some
no one start, well, some people start amazing at things, but then.
But they're one in a million.
Yeah.
You know, you learn
those
as
guys.
You go.
Yeah. So I stopped for a few years. Like that didn't really, I got to like 100 subscribers. And then like in 2016, so 4 years later, I was like, I'm going to give this another crack. I'm going to be a bit more real about it. Mm. So I made some reviews and I made some list videos. And the list videos were called, I think the first one was called 5 Graphically Impressive GBA Games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Driver on that list?
I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, and people were like, that's a title I can understand immediately. So they clicked
damn,
on that.
I can read.
Yeah, I can read. So I was kind of like going back and forth between writing video game reviews and then writing those videos, which felt like, you know, my side gig, even though they would get like 20, 30,000 views and my reviews would get like 1,000.
Yeah.
And so they eventually took off and then I just kind of like slowly steered the ship and just faded those out and faded in reviews of things that I actually wanted to talk about.
That's such a good system because like, I mean, if you start on that WatchMojo grind and like obviously your shit was probably a lot better than the stuff on WatchMojo.
Maybe it wasn't.
Let's say, let's
pretend it was.
I feel like they probably put in a bit more effort.
Yeah.
But if you start on that kind of grind, get people interested. And then move over to what you really want to talk about. I feel like not only does that make sense, but it also makes sense in like the way that YouTube has changed over time.
Yeah.
I feel like listicle videos did have that boom, that popularity. But now people are looking for more of like these fleshed out reviews of games. Maybe not, you know, 3-hour slogs by like H-Bomber Guy. I mean, I do watch
I love
them
those,
religiously.
Yeah.
But like, you know, not everyone's got the time and energy and Patreon to kind of really put in that effort. And sometimes you don't have that much to say about a video game, plain and simple. But I feel like people are getting more into like the video essays and like the fleshed out reviews of games nowadays. And like those listicles are kind of dying out.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I just happened to transition to the thing that's popular now.
Yeah. You did it at a perfect time.
Yeah, feels like it. Yeah, I agree. I think people just want to hear someone like nerd out about something.
Oh, yeah.
I think that. And like, yeah, I think that's the appeal of why people watch my videos. It's just like this guy cares way too much.
This podcast literally started as like me pitching like what if I got people on to talk about their special interests?
That's pretty much what this feels like.
Yeah, and that's basically what it is because I think it's – I will say, I feel like sometimes on YouTube, and at least in early YouTube, you had like fellas, and look, bless his heart, you had fellas like the Angry Video Game Nerd, right? Who like people love to watch him get so mad. This video game nerd, boy, was he angry, right?
I reckon.
And that was kind of the big sell, and there were so many copycats just like it. People love to watch dudes be like, this shit trash. But I feel like in recent years, people have sort of grown on the concept of people just talking about shit that they love.
Yeah.
Because it's so nice to hear someone talk about something that they're passionate about.
Yeah.
You can hear
magnetic.
The love. Yeah, yeah absolutely. Yeah. And it makes you interested in what they're talking about as well.
Yeah. And I think this may not be true. There's probably like a scientific study that's like,
speak your
you're
truth.
An idiot. But I think that like the world is so depressing that people want like happy things.
No, you're right. World sucks.
World sucks, man.
Shit's bad.
This is a nihilistic podcast.
Welcome to the podcast where we talk about where shit is really bad and fucked. But sometimes things are nice.
Yeah.
Like the Riddick game.
Like the Riddick game at GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Like it's funny. Like I think about like I don't want to bring up 9/11.
That is such a good way to start a sentence.
But after 9/11, we had a lot of really happy media. We had rom-coms.
Oh yeah.
We had cutesy puzzle platformers. Mm. We just had some cheery shit. And I feel like COVID has kicked off another wave of happy, happy media.
What did
escapism
look like in a post 9/11 world? But you're right. Like there was that moment of everything being real happy go lucky, and then there was that movie Remember Me, where they were like, you know what, it's been long enough.
Yeah, we can go here.
we can drop a random reference to 9/11 right at the end of this. Yeah, I feel like we are in a period of there's cozy games.
Yeah.
And there's good vibes games. And I feel like a lot of people trying to make more media that is comfy and nice.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned before that you've had people reach out to you and be like, I like watching your videos because your voice is really calming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you consider yourself to be one of those YouTubers that people like fall to sleep to?
Oh, I've been told a lot of people fall to sleep to my videos, which is nice. Yeah, it's funny, like, when I'm reading my scripts, I'm, like, trying to find a balance of where it sounds good, and sometimes I'm like, am I too loud for those people who are trying to fall asleep to me?
Should I quiet
like,
down?
Like, that's always in the back of my head now.
No, I watch a lot of Cat Icarus.
Yeah.
Love his videos.
Yeah, lovely man.
Recently, he's started releasing, like, I think he's got a new channel called Catty Sleeps, where it's all stuff to listen to go to sleep, but I used to just watch his regular videos and they'd lull me to sleep, but sometimes my eyes would just pop open because suddenly he's just gone crazy.
Jump scare. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, maybe I should watch something else. Oh my God. That was so scary.
Yeah, it's sort of come into my creative process, but I try not to like scare people. I even try not to like flashbang them with a white screen. Like I'm trying to keep it real calm now.
It's all about balance.
That's right.
So where do you start when you decide on a game to talk about?
I have like a big list on my phone, mostly of like, it's probably like half of games that I've just like, I hang out on Wikipedia a lot.
Good place to
Wikipedia be. Wikipedia and chill. I just kind of like find games. Like I found the Queen game.
Yeah.
The Queen, as in like Freddie Mercury's Queen, the game, just by browsing Wikipedia.
And was that like pre-movie or post-movie?
Oh, it was like 1997.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Which is post-Freddie.
Post-Freddie.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. Really fascinating. Like I interviewed the guy, the creative lead on it. Huh. I thought that he got contracted out like by Queen to make a game or something, but that's not what happened. He was working at EA and he pitched the game. He got in touch with the remaining Queen members and they all pitched the game to EA together. And EA were like, nah, this is not happening.
Sounds bad.
So then he and the remaining Queen members started a game studio to make this game. And they all like, they funded it together. And it was really fun talking to him because the game's bad. and he knows it's bad. He knows it didn't come together. But just hearing like both the creative process and working together with these like legendary musical figures and also the mental toll of it not working out when he poured like 5 years of his life into this project. I don't know how we got here, but there's a really fascinating conversation with him. Like, and that's another like, you know, another licensed game story that doesn't see the light of day. That's partly because the game was bad and no one cared.
You know, you've mentioned a few times now how you have kind of been in conversation with the people who have made these games. Seeking out those conversations, is that kind of at the forefront of your mind when you are looking to make a video about a certain licensed game?
It is. I often try to find them if I think there is something interesting about the development. Like, I'm currently working on a video about Tomorrow Never Dies, which is the game after GoldenEye.
Oh.
And I want to go talk to the guy who who had to make the game after GoldenEye. Ooh. You know, like I feel like that'll be fun.
That is interesting. Yeah. Something to live up to. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And like I guess with like video making being my job, it's hard to find people a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I need to get a video out to eat.
Yeah.
So there's that. But I do try when I think there is a cool story to be told in terms of how I pick a game.
Yeah.
Circling back.
What's that process like?
Yeah, I just try out games. And if they're like interesting, I go. And they're often not. So I'll probably try out like 4 or 5 games and then pick one.
Is it like kind of a process of like this needs to hook me in the first, let's say, 20 minutes or else I'm moving on? Yeah,
100%. You can tell pretty quick when a game is like doing something. Mm. Where you're like, this game's going for something. And those are the games I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever started playing a licensed game that, you know, you started playing to make a video about and, you know, you've done quite a bit of work in scripting and stuff and then gotten to a point where you're like, actually, f*** it, I'm canning this.
I can't think of like a licensed game example, but I can think of times I've done that. Like there's a game called The Saboteur, which came out 2009 by Pandemic. It was Pandemic's last game. And the internet loves it. Like they adore it because it's like set in this sort of romantic World War II France open world game, which is a cool concept. But I played it and I kept playing it and I was like, I do not like this game. Like this is really dumb. It's really poorly written, I think. People are going to hate me.
That's fine. Speak your truth.
And it's real clunky and bad. And then in my head, I'm like, here's a cult favorite game from 2009 that I don't like. Is there any reason for me to hop online and just shit on it?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Well, I mean, like, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that because, like, I was talking about the Angry Video Game before and, like, it is kind of – it's pretty easy to shit on old and bad games.
Yeah.
And I feel like you – I mean, from what I've seen in your videos, you – even if a game maybe is a little bit clunky or kind of misses the mark, you do try and see, like, the good in it and what makes it a special experience in its own right – rather than just being like, this game f***ing stinks. What deters you from just going hard on shitting on a game?
I don't find, like, I find it's really, like, the ways a game is bad is often very uncomplex, you know? Like, it's just like the controls are bad. Like,
okay.
Yeah. Like, what more to say is there than that?
Yeah.
And I think I do worry about, like, being too positive often on games, and like I've noticed that like my coverage will like a video will often follow this same flow of like this game is really really cool, does all these cool interesting things, but I don't recommend it and I wouldn't buy it. Don't play it. It's not actually good. I just find it interesting picking apart why things sort of psychologically click in your brain and feel good, and I find that a lot more fascinating. And like when I think about, I grew up writing reviews on GameSpot back in the day. But GameSpot was rad, man. Like they had like blogs and you had friends and you followed each other and you had banners. It was kind of like MySpace.
Yeah, I feel like GameSpot used to be a lot more kind of community
based. Yeah, super community based.
Yeah. It was back in the game FAQs.
Yeah, those days. Yeah. Video game reviews, I've always been drawn, like I guess if I'm talking about my inspirations, it's been like, magazine reviews always kind of were cool to me. Good Game was cool to me, so this is very surreal. GameSpot's reviews with like Jeff Gerstmann when he was helming the ship and then Kevin Van Ord after him was very good when they had Danny O'Dwyer around. It was cool. And there was a channel on YouTube called Classic Game Room I really liked. And sort of the through line between all of these where they were very like level-headed and pragmatic, and they approached a review with a real like, hey, let's kick back. Let's talk about a video game. No need to get angry here. You know, we can fall asleep to this if you like.
Yeah.
I think that's just come through into how I like to cover video games. Like I really never clicked with the angry video game nerd or the entire like normal boots wave after that never got me.
And nostalgia critic.
Yeah, that stuff. Oh, like I did not get it. So for me, that's it's fair. Always been like, I'm just sort of copycatting the people I like. Everyone is.
No, totally. I mean, like when I was doing stuff at Kotaku, when I first started, my mind for like video game coverage was like, I was a big fan of the magazine Endgamer back in the day. That was like my nice. Video game magazine yeah. that I was super, super into. And that, as well as big fan of Action Button Reviews.
Yeah, so good.
I think his review style, especially, and the way that like he kind of focuses a lot on like his personal experience and what the game means to him, and what the sort of response, both emotional and psychologically, that the game elicits from him. That's kind of where my brain goes to with reviews.
Yeah.
And when I was at Kotaku, I was also very picky about the games that I played, in the sense that I pretty much only ever played games that I ended up quite liking. I think there was only one game that I reviewed that I maybe didn't review super highly. But other than that, like, I was very lucky that I just played a lot of games that I liked.
Yeah.
But then I got worried of like, oh, people are just going to think that I'm only...
too positive?
Yeah, like, that yeah, I'm way too positive. Yeah, you just like everything.
Yeah, I get accused of that a lot. It's just like, I'm not going to play something I don't like.
Yeah,
like,
why waste your time?
Yeah, exactly.
Why waste your time? Somebody else that I work with can do it, or somebody else on YouTube can do it. Like...
yeah, and like the games I play are pretty bad. Like,
yeah, you're being pretty. Like, you're saying
like I'm
the
trying
good.
To be even, but you know,
yeah,
I just don't want to put myself through more pain.
Yeah, and you know what? There's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
I think so. Valid.
But like, I'm not working for a publication. I'm not having games put on my desk to review. I'm picking them, so I get to pick the ones I like, which is cool.
Yeah,
yeah,
and it's nice to play games that you like.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well said.
Thank you. And on that note, Peter, thank you so, so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
Today. How can people find out more about your work?
Mini Me. Just Google Mini Me, MiniMe, which is terrible for SEO. Well, it's kind of good for SEO if you know.
Yeah, if you specifically.
Yeah, if you know. But if I'm just telling people, like, Google Mini Me, like, what are you talking? Like, Austin Powers? Like,
oh, the little guy from Austin.
Yeah, the little guy. I'm on YouTube mainly. Like, I have a Twitter, but Twitter scares me.
That's fair.
And yeah, subscribe, watch some videos. I think they're good, personally.
Like and subscribe.
Hit the bell.
Hit the bell so you know when I release a new video.
That's right. Stay up to date.
Oh, yeah.
I can't. just a little PTSD hitting me there.
That's fair. But yeah, thank you so much again for coming
on. Yeah, absolutely. It's been so much fun.
And a big thank you to you for listening. If you're liking what you're hearing and you'd like to hear more, consider supporting Back Pocket Over on Patreon. If you support us at the silver tier and above, you can get access to our bonus episodes. In this week's bonus episode, we'll be guessing which licensed games are real and which ones are made up. Here's a sneak peek.
I haven't heard of a game, and I'm just going to stop playing mind games with myself and say there. Oh, God, you're smiling. I'll say there isn't one because it's my gut feeling. But now you're going to say there is one.
And you'd be wrong. And hey, if you really like what you're hearing, why not give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you're using? Better yet, why not give us a nice little review? You can also find us on Twitch, where we've got our main live show every Thursday from 7 p.m. and on TikTok, where we're constantly posting very good stuff for you to cast your big, beautiful eyes on. And then there's the socials, all our Twitter and Threads and whatnot, which you're also welcome to get around. Once again, thanks so much for tuning in, and as famed video game developer Vin Diesel would say, bye!
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.